I wanted to mention that there are two things that I've done in studying the ground that I was interested in. I believe I mentioned these in the first class, or perhaps I mentioned them in the class on study. And that is that the guardian has chosen certain key passages from the Kitab-e-Gan to quote in chose these paragraphs and extracts from the Igan. So I went into the Igan and searched to find out where they were and marked them in my book, my particular copy. I've outlined the whole quotation in green, as it turns out, but I have a bit of color coding in it because I've got various things going on. But these boxed items are extracts that are cited by Shoghi Effendi in the dispensation. So when you come through it, if you want to arrange your book in such a way that you can identify these passages and realize that they have been given a special emphasis elsewhere by Shoghi Effendi, you might find that a helpful way of centering on the items at hand. Now, beyond that, I have some larger extracts which I've got outlined in blue here. And they are the sections of the gleanings that have come from the Igan. And the Igan passages from the that are cited in the gleanings by the guardian in his selection are 24 in number, and they're grouped into six sections in the gleanings. We'll give you the section numbers gradually as we work through some of those quotations. I wanted to cite a few of these extracts from the dispensation that are cited in the dispensation to see what is it that the guardian has chosen. There are a number of shorter passages that have been grouped into paragraphs. The subjects are God the Unknowable Essence, the appearance of God's Prophet, the power and sovereignty of the Prophet, the unity of the Prophet, and the continuity of divine revelation. Now, if you consider how that runs parallel with this list of themes that we discussed last week, the major themes of the Kitab-e-Gan, you see how these are the central aspects of the cause. First, he cites about God the Unknowable Essence. He who in unnumbered passages claimed his utterance to be the voice of divinity, the call of God himself, thus solemnly affirms in the Kitab-e-Gan, "To every discerning and illumined heart, it is evident that God, the unknowable essence, the divine being, is immeasurably exalted beyond every human attribute, such as corporeal existence, ascent and descent, egress and regress. He is and hath ever been veiled in the ancient eternity of his essence, and will remain in his reality everlastingly hidden from the sight of men. He standeth exalted beyond and above all separation and union, all proximity and remoteness. God was alone. There was none else beside him," is a sure testimony of this truth. In that latter part, God was alone, there was none else beside him, is from the Quran. It's like an affirmation of the explanation that he's making. For those of you who might have had to look in the dictionary the first time they came across the word egress and regress, it means coming in and going out, basically. Coming down and going back again, going up again, or in or out of a body, or whatever we might imagine a manifestation, I mean, that God himself might do, as believed by some of the sects of the various religions. Then the second theme is on the appearance of God's prophet. Having established, and this is all these citations are at the beginning of the second part of the Quran, which is kind of the center of the book somehow is the most intense part of the book from the point of view of these truths. Here we have the situation that God doesn't come close, he doesn't go far, there's no proximity, there's no remoteness connected with him. He entirely transcends anything and everything that we can understand. So we say, well, then how are we going to know and worship God? How are we going to know and love God? How does this work? Baha'u'llah explains, he says, the door of the knowledge of the Ancient of Days, being thus closed in the face of all beings, he, the source of infinite grace, hath caused those luminous gems of holiness, a title of a manifestation, gems of holiness, to appear out of the realm of the spirit, in the noble form of the human temple, and be made manifest unto all men, that they may impart unto the world the mysteries of the unchangeable being, and tell of the subtleties of his imperishable essence. All the prophets of God, his well-favored, his holy and chosen messengers, are without exception the bearers of his name and the embodiments of his attributes. And again, these tabernacles of holiness, these primal mirrors, which reflect the light of unfading glory, are but expressions of him who is the invisible of the invisible. The means of access, the mirrors of his life, of his favors, the embodiments of the qualities and names which we attribute to God, all centered in the manifestation of God who appears from age to age. On the power and sovereignty of the prophet. In another place he says, they who are the luminaries of truth and the mirrors reflecting the light of divine unity. Baha'u'llah explains in the Quran, in whatever age and cycle they are sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world, to educate the souls of men and endue with grace all created things, are invariably endowed with an all-compelling power and invested with invincible sovereignty. In another spot, he further elaborates this theme. These sanctified mirrors, these day springs of ancient glory, are one and all the exponents on earth of him who is the central orb of the universe, its essence and ultimate purpose. From him proceed their knowledge and power. From him is derived their sovereignty. The beauty of their countenance is but a reflection of his image, and their revelation a sign of his deathless glory. Through them is transmitted a grace that is infinite, and by them is revealed a light that can never fade. Human tongue can never befittingly sing their praise, and human speech can never unfold their mystery. We are mentioning that personality, Abu Baz is in one of his tablets, that personality is in the manifestation of God, not in the essence of God. That which we feel close to, which we know, which we relate to, is the spirit of the manifestation of God. that is in God in his essence. And this has been, the creation has been made this way. They are the fountainheads of his favors, the wellspring of his grace to us, the mirrors of his presence, and constitute the means of our approaching or pulling away, making ourselves, distancing ourselves from God. In fact, in another tablet, he says that closeness to God or farness to God really means closeness or farness to the manifestation of Christ. Because, again, we've heard these statements from Baha'u'llah that God entertains no proximity or remoteness in his essence. He transcends entirely. Yet, he says, he's closer to you than your jugular vein and your life vein. And the question of where he is everywhere, but inaccessible. Now, if you imagine the infinity of the universe and you imagine the being that must be behind it, you realize how your head kind of comes short, all your thoughts. There's nothing to relate to. It's too much to relate to. And part of the mercy of God, part of the grace of God, not a deprivation, but part of his mercy and grace is that he has constituted beings that appear to be like us, come amongst us, and guide us in the ways of his truth. What a mercy that is for us. You notice how he says they have sent down from their invisible habitations of ancient glory unto this world to educate the souls of men and to endue with grace all created things. You'll recall Sogyi Effendi in his letters has spoken about the difference between the nature of the soul of the manifestation of God and the souls that we possess. On the one hand, that divine soul, he says, has the position among stellar bodies of the sun, if you were to draw a likeness with stellar bodies. The manifestation is like the sun, and our souls are like planets. We do not emit light, we reflect light. And in order for there to be any illumination whatsoever in our existence and in our being and on the surface of our reality, we need the light of the sun. We need to circle around the sun. The other distinction he makes, he says, is that the souls of the manifestations of God, contrary to the souls of other human beings, are pre-existent. They have had a reality of their own, a distinct individuality in the worlds of God before coming here. And though they don't come twice to the same world, there is not this idea of reincarnation, but they come from a realm where they've been prepared, and they come here, and they play out the drama of their life, and they return again to those celestial realms. In one passage, Abdu'l-Bahá talks about them, how they really inhabit the realms of glory, what he calls the Jabarut. At all times, their reality is in the Jabarut, though their body and their outer being is here. Their spiritual state is constantly in the highest of all possible worlds as far as created beings are concerned. I heard a story was told from the writings of the Bab. I haven't seen the tablet itself, but I'll tell it to you. Just bear in mind that we don't have the text. I don't have the text in front of me. I can't cite it for you. But the gist of it is that the Bab, in one of his tablets addressed to the clergy in Iran, has said that ere the moment I chose to appear within my mother's womb, I repaired unto the presence of Muhammad. And we discussed there what should be the punishment and destiny of the Shia clergy for what they have done to the faith of Islam. All right, now you get this picture of Muhammad and the Bab talking before the Bab makes his appearance in the realm of being. The thing is, it's very suggestive of not that he was some kind of a force in the universe who became then the manifestation of God, but that he had an individual reality as well in that realm. Well, these are, you know, the dramas expressed by their manifestations in their writings. We can't penetrate the full meaning of these things, and Shoghi Effendi himself has said, we have no way of understanding what their existence or reality was like before they came to this world. In the Qayyum al-Asma, likewise, the Bab describes the scene where he says that God calls together all the manifestations of God, this concourse of the messengers, the souls of the messengers of God. And he announced unto them the eventual appearance of Baha'u'llah. And all of them immediately fell on their faces in submission to such a being. Except four, he says. Four of the manifestations blinked, and then they fell. And he said, God saw them blink, and verily he has drawn them near to the fire to purify them from this hesitation. And then he goes on and he names the four. One of them was Adam, the one who started our universal cycle. Another was Shoaib, who's mentioned here. And he's gone. And another was, what was Aaron? I don't want to name the wrong ones. Poor fellows were messengers of God. But anyway, this gives you some feeling of what kind of dramas go on in the other world. What are the meaning of it? I don't know what it is, but you know, and who was God on that occasion to announce that Baha'u'llah was coming when we read these other things that he never appears and you never know him and you never see him. So that's also full of all kinds of mysteries. But the suggestive part is that there are dramas in the other world before coming here and after leaving, and you know, that's how it all works. So these beings are sent down from there. Then you say, well, why don't they know who they are when they come here? Well, Abdullah says that they all are aware of the mysteries of existence from the beginning. And they have this innate knowledge in them. Well, then why do they have a time when they discover they're the messenger of God? I don't know if that's exactly true. I think it seems to be more that they have a time when they discover what their mission will be. In other words, their mission is then announced to them. The manifestation of God seems to have all knowledge from his position out to creation, but not back towards God. And there's several passages in the Quran which relate the same extraordinary mystery of God, the essence. And we've talked about this here a little bit last week, I think, or the week before, about how the manifestation understands God in his own reality. As he feels the power of God in his own being, as we feel from time to time the power of God in our own being after prayer or in teaching work, and we realize that this is something that transcends our own possibility. There's something extra there, beyond that. And how thrilling that is, and how we long to acquire the correct attitude, the correct stability of spirit, if you will, to enjoy that grace and that added assistance in our lives at all times. And of course the great heroes and saints of the faith had themselves centered in that. And Abdu'l-Bahá told Guru Gessinger when she was going to India, you'll recall that famous talk that he gave her about attaining to the invariability of the inner state, that there is a condition of detachment and where one is constantly in a state of attraction. And in a tablet also which reminds one of Martha Ruth, Abdu'l-Bahá said that there is a condition that one can attain in teaching where physical means are no longer needed. In other words, the person is so guided as to things are arranged for them. All right, you see it as coincidence or whatever happens, but somehow everything works out, and the person who would never have gone out if they were thinking, how am I going to get home tonight? I have no money, and I'm going to a Baha'i meeting, and then what am I going to do after that? Says, never mind about that, I'm going to the Baha'i meeting, and then we'll see what happens. And there's a story, again, of Martha Ruth, that when she was in San Francisco at the end of one of her trips across the Pacific, she had a public meeting in San Francisco, and she went there to this public meeting, and she used the last coins in her purse to pay for the trolley car to go to the meeting. And she didn't have any money to go back to a hotel. She had a little bag with her. She brought that to the meeting. And she gave her talk. And there was a group of people there. And there was one woman that she noticed her face was shining all the time. And it got shinier and shinier. And she came up after her and she said, I want my family to hear this. I know it's an inconvenience, but could you come with me this very night to my country home and spend some time with our family? You know? And she wrote about this. She said, this is the kind of thing that happened all the time. things happen, things would occur, you know. So that's a level of trust in God and assurance of things that are going to happen, which makes the teaching work much easier. Now he touches on the theme of the unity of the prophets. We've heard last week that Sylvia Fendi, in recalling these themes, talks about the twofold character of the station of the manifestations of God. There is their transcendent abstract state, which is one, whole, unique for all the manifestations of God. And then there is an individual reality, which is their personality, their name, the time they appear in history, all those individual aspects of their being. With regard to the unity, this famous phrase that you've heard so often, inasmuch as these birds of the celestial throne are all sent down from the heaven of the will of God, and as they all arise to proclaim his irresistible faith, they therefore are regarded as one soul and the same person. They all abide in the same tabernacle, soar in the same heaven, are seated upon the same throne, utter the same speech, and proclaim the same faith. They only differ in the intensity of their revelation and the comparative potency of their light. That a certain attribute of God hath not been outwardly manifested by these essences of detachment doth in no wise imply that they are, who are the dayspring of God's attributes and the treasuries of his holy name, did not actually possess it. The nature of their revelation, the intensity, the comparative difference in the potency of the light they reveal has to do with the receptivity and capacity of humanity in the day that they appear, and not with any essential difference in their own nature. And so, on the one hand, we see Baha'u'llah in a central, supreme position, the supreme manifestation of God, the holiest manifestation that's ever appeared. But that holiest manifestation of God in that sense is not that he's holier than the others, but that his mission, his revelation, he has been allowed to shine in his mission in a way that no manifestation of God in recorded history has been allowed to shine, and to reveal mysteries and knowledge that were never revealed before. But he himself has said that if the people had been prepared in the time of Jesus Christ for this revelation, Jesus Christ would have revealed it. The nature of the manifestation is such that any of them could have brought the mission of Baha'u'llah, but this was not the time. So in that sense, we should be careful about drawing a distinction. But on the other hand, we have to remember that Baha'u'llah has been placed in this position, and just as the Bab, who is at his right hand and is called the King of the Messengers of God, the Monarch of the Prophets of God, he has his special station in the hierarchy of the Prophets. So likewise, Baha'u'llah has this very central position in the realms on high and in his relation to not only his own dispensation, but the dispensations from the beginning of the Adamic cycle, and all those, that series of prophets and messengers of God who are to appear for the next half million years under the shadow, drawing spiritual inspiration from Baha'u'llah's revelation, from his mission. We're just too close to it to have any idea of its magnitude. It just overshadows us, and we have only the experience of prophets coming along in the past every 1,000 years or so and having a religion, and here we come with another one, and this is Baha'u'llah, and he has his religion. And this is the kind of the way we're understanding it. And it's part of the way we need to understand it to be able to teach it in the first instance to the people of the previous dispensation so that they can understand progressive revelation, how it goes on. And while that is one reality, there is this other dimension of Baha'u'llah's greatness, of the fact that he speaks from this level of divinity, oftentimes in the first person of God's voice speaking through him. He's endowed this day with that special title of the Day of God Himself. Finally, there's this last section that's cited in the dispensation on the continuity of divine revelation. Sanjogi Effendi here combines four lines from the Ezan with his own conclusion. I'll read it with Shogasan, these words together. To believe that all revelation is ended, that the portals of divine mercy are closed, that from the day springs of eternal holiness no sun shall rise again, that the ocean of everlasting bounty is forever still, and that out of the tabernacle of ancient glory the messengers of God have ceased to be made manifest, must constitute in the eyes of every follower of the faith a grave and inexcusable departure from one of its most cherished and fundamental principles. Now, you remember we were talking about this fundamental principle of the relativity of religious truth, that religious revelation is progressive, that there's no end to it, there's no final revelation in which everything is given and nothing else comes up from it. It's all relative to our universal cycle, to the universe we live in, to so many other things, the society we've come from, the state of humanity at the time of the appearance of the manifestation of God. These are the passages from the dispensation. You can find them on pages 113 of the World Order of Baha'u'llah, pages 113, 114, 115, and 116. And they're all identified as coming from the Ugan. Then you'll have the fun of looking to see where you find them in the Ugan. Let's look a little at the two different parts of the Ugan. We read those opening paragraphs. Sense we can say that the basic themes of part one are the standards of humanity versus the standards of God and the need for detachment. There's a brief review of the persecution of past prophets. There's a discussion of the reasons for the persecution of the manifestations of God. There's a symbolic interpretation of verses from the Bible, Matthew 24 verses 29 to 31. And numerous symbols in that passage are explained. It also affirms the validity of the Quran and the Bible and the true meaning of the phrase corruption of the text, which is discussed towards the end of part one. The basic themes of part two seem to be the unknowability of God, and because of this, the appearance, continual successive appearance of his manifestations, his messengers, the meaning of the sovereignty of the manifestations of God. So outwardly they seem to be bereft of sovereignty, yet inwardly they possess control over everything. The twofold language which all the manifestations of God speak, an explanation on the day of resurrection and its meaning. Again, this dual station of the manifestations of God, the two aspects of their being, the passages regarding the qualifications of the true seekers after the Beloved, and then a series of proofs related to the Bab's mission cited by Baha'u'llah here, with that intention of serving as proofs of the Bab. One thing you'll notice in reading through, if you've been reading Ugan, you've seen how often Baha'u'llah refers to the words or such as ponder, explore, observe, contemplate, reflect, examine, consider, meditate, strive to comprehend the verses.
it's an exercise of will. It's an exercise of concentration. It's an exercise of balance. It's an exercise of attitude, spiritual attitude towards the text. And the repetition of these realities and the importance that they're given within the setting of the revelation make us want to try to penetrate and understand this thing. You know, and say, well, kind of high am I if I read the Quran and it just seems like an ordinary book to me. And if I read it with just this eye of superficial reading it out. Baha'u'llah, in the course of the book, gives us some promises about if we do ponder the verses of the Quran, what will happen to us? I'll read a few of these for you. He says, we'll attain the nest of faith and certainty, drink deep from the water of ancient wisdom, partake of the fruits of the tree of divine knowledge, find the doors of understanding, divine wisdom, and infinite knowledge unlocked and flung open before your face. Find all knowledge and the mysteries thereof unveiled before your eyes. Understand the ways of the prophets of God. Grasp the purpose of God for your existence. Apprehend the mysteries of the symbolic terms found in the Holy Book. Seize the significance of all the abstruse problems of this day which have become barriers between men and the knowledge of the Day of Judgment. Find whatsoever ye seek and apprehend the greatness of the revelation of God. There's page numbers here for those if you want to see them after the collection. Again, as Abdul Baha said, he cited earlier in the course, mere reading of the holy books and texts will not suffice. We shouldn't be satisfied with words, but seek to understand the spiritual meanings hidden in the heart of the words. He affirms himself, it is difficult to comprehend even the words of a philosopher. How much more difficult it is to understand the words of God. Again, he said, it is easy to read the Holy Scriptures, but it is only with a clean heart and a pure mind that one may understand their true meaning. Let us ask God's help to enable us to understand the Holy Book. Let us pray for eyes to see, and ears to hear, and hearts that long for peace. Now, this question of a clean heart and a pure mind so that one may understand the true meaning of the text gives us some indication why living the Baha'i life is so important. We can't decide, well, the Baha'i life is one thing and my knowledge of the revelation is another. I'm going to study and learn everything I can, because it is in our action and in our behavior lie the keys to whether we're going to be able to attain to certain levels of comprehension and understanding. They have to do with detachment from the world. They have to do with attraction to God. They have to do with the illumination and stirring of the soul by those breezes and graces which flow from the text. And all of that predisposes us to being able to concentrate, it would seem, in the right manner, so that our eyes begin to see and our ears begin to hear, and we begin to acquire and attain to some of these things which are not communicable in words. But our reality, present at this very moment, Baha'u'llah says, if the grace of God were removed from humanity or from any of us for an instant, we would all perish. All of these heavenly treasures are at hand. He says, take but one step and you're the next enter the realm of eternity or of eternal understanding or of spiritual comprehension. He gives us these, suggests the very tantalizing closeness of all of it. But it requires some steps on our part, like sacrificing everything we have and giving up every desire and notion that we had in the past and throwing away our whole system of knowledge. You can't shed it all at once because you'll fall down. And you need to keep some of it. Shed it as you can. As you absorb spiritual truth, remove the things that aren't necessary. Leave them behind. This is the same idea that the world and the kingdom are in opposite positions. If we're close to the world, we're far from the kingdom. If we draw ourselves up, focus on spiritual truths, we begin to let those fill our lives, fill our minds, and that becomes the desire and hope of our life, then we move away from the world. We don't have any means, reason to have to be chopping our attachments to the world, because they simply dissolve in the effect of that. Whereas if we focus on trying to stop the attachments we have to the world and not focus on spiritual, there's no way we'll do it. It's like trying to get rid of darkness without light. It's an impossible task. So basically the way out of whatever gloom sometimes settles on us, whatever sadness is in us, whatever dissatisfaction is in us, is this gradual absorption with the means that the manifestation of God sets forth as those upon which we should be meditating, thinking, pondering, reflecting, comprehending. And the Dhyan is full of them. Now, do you have any questions about what we, some of the things we had last week? You may have some leftover questions, please. There's page numbers for all of them. You know? First three are on page 6 and goes on page 52, 2 on page 52, 53, 57. Yes, they're all in Nizam. The promise is in Nizam. Other comments or questions? You may have a question that you say, oh, I don't want to, I can't ask this question. But it's probably some question that somebody else has too. If you've got one, please, Tom. Yes. Yes, those are my, I should warn you, those are my own titles for the for these various citations from the dispensation, from the Granth quoted in the dispensation. God, the Unknowable Essence. On God, the New and Noble Essence, on the appearance of God's prophets, on the power and sovereignty of the prophets, on the unity of the prophets, on the continuity of divine revelation. Anything else you think of? Right now, would we like to ask or comment on? Now we come one stage further. We're considering part one. We're looking at the first 50 pages, let us say. We're going to look at the Dhyan more or less in groupings of 50 pages. There are 250 pages, that's about 5 sessions, right? We look at them and consider some of the major themes that are found in these sections and some of the major passages. How can we do this? We can't take 50 pages and read them in one session. So this carries us to the next stage of our observation of how Shoghi Effendi has culled from the Izan certain basic passages and brought them to our attention. And those are the passages, once again, that I mentioned at the beginning, that he's placed in the gleanings along with selections from so many other writings of Baha'u'llah, including the Kitab-i-Aqdas, a number of passages here from the Kitab-i-Aqdas as well, some from Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And this was Shoghi Effendi's selection of Baha'u'llah's writings suitable for the West and for the conveying of the truths of the revelation to the public, not just to the Baha'is, but to the public, quite suitable for the public. The first section in Gleanings, which cites the passages, from the Dhyan, is section 13, pages 17 to 27 of the of this particular edition, and also the smaller red edition of the Greenings. It will be different in the British version, or if you have this collected writings of Baha'u'llah from India. But you can find it by the section, Greening section 13. Now, before we do that, I want to give you one of these handouts here. This is a sequential outline of the text. It happens to be one that I prepared while I was studying Gan for several times. It's since been polished up a little here and a little there. Any outline of the text has to choose a level of complexity that it's going to convey. You could have an outline of the text which could include every word of the Gan if you wanted, and that might be a very useful exercise, how to outline it with every sentence being either a major theme or a sub-theme or whatever. I was interested in, since there are so many subjects dealt with in the Gan, I was interested in more of having a topical outline, and yet not arranged according to topics, but in sequence, so that one could kind of glance through it and find that section that you knew where it was, but you didn't know what word to find it in the index. And also to be able to take a fast overview of 50 pages or 100 pages of the Gan at once to see what the themes were. I have a little preparatory note here. It says, the following outline represents one effort to identify the important subject matter of the Gan and the order in which it appears in the text. The task is formidable. The outline is not intended to be fully comprehensive, but rather to serve as an aid in locating various subjects. It is suggested the student should consider preparing his own version. It proves a very helpful exercise for coming to an understanding of the structure of the book as a whole, and leads to an appreciation of how the Gan is composed of a number of themes, all beautifully interwoven. This sequential approach does not adequately deal with this interweaving. The numbers following each entry below refer to pages in the Gan, and in this case, as in the other handouts, to the page numbering found in the American edition of the Gan. Back in the first place scene is blank, but it's the thing doesn't lose. You haven't lost the page if you have a blank page. It's continuing on the second sheet. Now, you can have a look at this, and if you're going to prepare your own, you can set it aside and just start to task yourself, see what you come up with. In some of the other courses in the past, students have given me copies of their own outlines, very helpful, and I've revised this at times in accordance with things that they've pointed out. There's some attempt to try to find major themes and minor themes by the indentation process. That, again, is my own subjective understanding of emphasis and order in the book. You will want to question it. You will want to see, is this so or isn't this so, or how do you feel about it? there is no final version of this available. And I'm sure there are ties and connections that one doesn't see even after many readings. And then suddenly, perhaps the next time you look at the book, you find these connections, reflections back and forth. Does everyone have a copy now? So it starts off with the theme of detachment, the key to true understanding, and then the requirements of those who tread the path of faith and who want to attain to detachment. Then this Then there's a section here which deals with the cause of the denial on the part of the people of the prophets of the past, and the mention of the Surah of Hud from the Quran, then accounts of the cruelties suffered by the prophets of the past, and it deals specifically with Noah, with Hud, with Saleh, with Abraham, Moses and Jesus. Then there's a rather longer section, 5 pages, on the denials of the religious leaders. References to the unfoldment of the mysteries of the verses, reference to the coming and return of the prophets, the theme of distinction, variation, and the unity of the prophets, the question of the meaning, spiritual meaning, of food and of bread. Then begins the explanation of the meaning of Matthew 24, from chapter Matthew 24, verses 29 to 31, and that's continued from page 24 to page 48, and also after a break in which other material is introduced, Baha'u'llah returns to the theme, pages 61 to 80. Within that explanation, he deals with the meanings of various things. He refers to the very important passage on the sons of truth, in other words, the manifestations of God. He talks about oppression being an essential feature of every revelation, the highest purpose of creation. The sun and the moon are interpreted. And the interpretation of the sun and the moon, he deals with then sons of truth, religious leaders, laws and teachings, prayer and fasting. What the darkening of the sun and moon stands for, what the cleaving of heaven means. He calls upon us to consider hardship and bitterness of the lives of the prophets. What is the meaning of the changing of the earth, and refers to knowledge as a light. And then the purpose of the symbolic terms, he says, is to test and prove people, that the sincere may be known from the false, and elaborates that theme from page 49 to page 59. Well, that's the section that we're going to be considering a little more tonight, and then next week we'll still have to go on with this, I think. Now you can either read a section and then look at an outline like this, or you could look at the outline first and then read this section and see how, find the different points, see where they come, and ask yourselves, why did I leave out the reference to the subject and paragraph, whatever it is. We're going to have some reading of the major passages, a few major passages from this to end the class this evening. I want to pass out a list of questions on the first 100 pages of the book that we're going to suggest that you try to find the answers for by looking in the text. They're all answered clearly in the text. It'll give you something to aim at. If you've read it already, you can search through. If you haven't read it and have the possibility, you can read through and try to find these. They're not especially tricky questions. They're questions really designed to draw your attention to the central themes, to the major points that Bhavala is making. And also now, if you'll come prepared next week with any points that you would like to know something further about, which we may have some additional notes, annotations on, that we can refer to, or points that you think need further clarification. If we don't have it, maybe somebody else has already looked for a clarification or found something or can cite something in the writings about it, and we can help each other to see if we can solve some of the questions that arise that we might not otherwise know the answer to. For instance, Baha'u'llah in he's talking about some traditions, and he's saying, you know, as it says, as it has been said, that after such an event there were 40 or 72 of the followers of one of the prophets remained. And you think, well, you know, you could say 3 or 4 or 10 or 15, but why 40 or 72? And it happens that there's two contradictive hadiths or traditional sayings of Islam, one which cites 40 followers remain and one which cites 72. If Baha'u'llah cited only one of them, he'd have all the people saying, oh, he doesn't know about the other one. So he just says 40 or 72. So he doesn't solve the problem of which is the correct one, but he gives you the understanding. And that's why you have something strange, kind of a reference to 40 and 72. So some of these little things help to know if you know them, or if you've kind of tripped over them at the time, if you have an explanation. When you're leading classes on the Igaan, when you go back out into the world, or when you're traveling on your holidays, if you're here indefinitely, maybe you'll be giving classes on the Igaan, and you'll have these kind of notes that are a result of a lot of study of the Igaan in the past to help you to respond to questions and queries that the friends may have when they first start moving through this ocean of knowledge. Let me pass these out. A little exercise now. If you don't want the questions, just don't take a copy. But if you want them, you're welcome. should be room here for you to write down the page numbers where you find the answers to these questions. In some cases, you might find more than one answer. There may be several quotations that seem to suit it, or a whole paragraph, or a whole page, if you will. And for next week, it's really just the first 11 questions that you could refer to. Can what? Online for answers? On the what? On the terminal, sure, you could do that if you wanted. When the course was made, there wasn't anything online. In fact, the first thing that went online here was the Egon. That was the first of the sacred writing project. It was an experiment, but it fit in very well with the course I was giving at the time, so I took advantage of it too. But there's something that's very healthy about scanning the book. Now, you can scan it in the machine, but if you look for things, you'll learn more about what the whole general order and unfoldment of it is. Which is much quicker? That's much quicker to find the specific answer to what you're looking for. But it's much quicker to learn the book by opening it and reading various pages and finding the answers. That also has revealing, you know. If everything we know we need a computer to find, we may be caught short sometime on a platform till we get our wristwatch computers going where we can see it, have it embedded in the back of our head and projected to our brains or some such thing. I don't know what's coming in the future, but until such time, I suggest you have hard copies of the books, no matter what computer programs you have. Andishe has kindly consented to read a few of these passages for us, which you may comment a little on, from the Gleaning section 13. And again, the first part of this, you can find these now, you can follow in the book. The first one is on page 4. Consider the past, it starts.
Consider the past. How many, both high and low, have at all times yearningly awaited the advent of the manifestations of God in the sanctified persons of His chosen ones? How often have they expected His coming? How frequently have they prayed that the breeze of divine mercy might blow and the promised beauty step forth from behind the veil of concealment and be made manifest to all the world? And whensoever the portals of grace did open and the clouds of divine bounty did rain upon mankind and the light of the unseen did shine above the horizon of celestial might, they all denied Him and turned away from His face, the face of God Himself.
Now, the fact that we're skipping other important passages, when we come back to the review of them, we'll look at various other things too. But this is just to show you what the Guardian has selected from these pages. Now we come over, let's see. The second section, he skips to page 13. Reflect, what could have been the motive for such deeds?
Reflect, what could have been the motive for such deeds? What could have prompted such behavior towards the revealers of the beauty of the All-Glorious? Whatever in days gone by hath been the cause of the denial and opposition of those people hath now led to the perversity of the people of this age. To maintain that the testimony of Providence was incomplete, but it hath therefore been the cause of the denial of the people, is but open blasphemy. How far from the grace of the All-Bountiful and from his loving providence and tender mercies it is, to single out a soul from amongst all men for the guidance of his creatures, and on one hand, to withhold from him the full measure of his divine testimony, and on the other, inflict severe retribution on his people for having turned away from his chosen one. Nay, the manifold bounties of the Lord of all beings have at all times, through the manifestations of his divine essence, encompassed the earth and all that dwell therein. Not for a moment hath his grace been withheld, nor have the showers of his loving kindness ceased to rain upon mankind. Consequently, such behavior can be attributed to naught save the petty-mindedness of such souls as tread the valley of arrogance and pride, are lost in the wilds of remoteness, walk in the ways of their idle fancy, and follow the dictates of the leaders of their faith. Their chief concern is mere opposition. Their sole desire is to ignore the truth. Unto every discerning observer, it is evident and manifest that had these people, in the days of each of the manifestations of the Son of Truth, sanctified their ears, their eyes, and their hearts from whatever they had seen, heard, and felt, they surely would not have been deprived of beholding the beauty of God, nor strayed far from the habitations of glory. But, having weighed the testimony of God by the standard of their own knowledge, gleaned from the teachings of the leaders of their faith, and found it at variance with their limited understanding, they arose to perpetrate such unseemly acts.
Two things that I'd like to mention now. One is you may want to look at the Agon from various aspects. One aspect that's interesting to bear in mind here is the question of spiritual geography. In the passage we've just read, we've read about such things as the valley of arrogance and pride, the wilds of remoteness, the showers of his loving kindness. All of these symbols that we have from the world of nature around us, which are used here in various ways. It's very interesting to make a map in your own mind. You'll see many more examples of this within the text itself. Another is something that I found very helpful, is in the outer margins to do cross-referencing. When you find passages that are linked to each other in some way, put a cross-reference to the other passage in this spot and likewise at the other point. For instance, where it says, but having weighed the testimony of God by the standard of their own knowledge, I have a reference back to page 4, which, as you'll recall, has this same subject. That no one can ever enter the abode of immortality unless and until he ceases to regard the words and deeds of mortal men as a standard for the true understanding and recognition of God and his prophets. So this then is cross-referenced on page 4 to page 15. There's another reference, which I don't know what it is, we'll look, it's on to page 68. Let's see what that one is. It's the same subject. Seems to be something different, and I don't have the page here. Not sure what that one refers to. Hold on a second. Let's look on 211. That's the other reference I have here. So this will give you a better idea. Ah, On page 211, it says, "The understanding of his words and the comprehension of the utterances of the birds of heaven are in no wise dependent upon human learning. They depend solely upon purity of heart, chastity of soul, and freedom of spirit." There's a cross-reference here in the first section we read on page 4 about the advent of the manifestations of God, how high and low all the people have been waiting for that, for the advent of these chosen ones. Excuse me. And there'll be something about their appearance anywhere on this other page, on page 142. You can find these yourselves. Sometimes I don't have them, the obvious connection right there, but once you read about it and ponder about it, you'll see how it is. Now, I wouldn't want you to copy my cross-references, but you should make your own set of them if you find that useful. It's a way that immediately you have some elucidation in another part of the book for something that's not fully explained somewhere else. Read that. Thank you. That brings us to the end of our time. Now, these other gleaning passages we'll take up next week. But they're principally pages 11 to 12, 17 to 19, and 20 to 22. So I wish you a week of profitable reading and studying on the Gan, and we'll see what we can uncover next week.